It's a rare person who doesn't feel some sense of calm or serenity standing on the banks of a river. Today's guest has felt that plenty, but has also spent much of his career going quite a bit deeper, trying to understand the complex ecosystems that surround rivers, above and below water, within and without the banks. Dr. Kurt Fausch gives us the benefits of his research and knowledge in his book, For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey. Kurt Fausch is a professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. He's been there for 33 years now. He's researched rivers all over the world, including a stint in Japan featured on a PBS documentary called River Webs. Dr. Kurt Fausch, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Good to have you here. It sounds like you started your study of rivers young in Michigan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I went to graduate school at Michigan State University to study streams and mainly to work on trout populations. I got interested in how it is that non-native trout in Michigan, and there that's, for example, brown trout that were introduced from Europe, how they were pushing out potentially the native trout, which there are brook trout. So it seemed like the best way to do that was to get underwater and actually see what the fish are doing, look at the positions that they hold, figure out what they're actually competing for. And so I started out my work snorkeling in those rivers in Michigan.
It sounds like it's a fairly uncomfortable pursuit at times.
Yeah, you're snorkeling in a trout stream, so it can be down in the 40s a degree Fahrenheit or low 50s, and definitely need to be wearing, in those days, wetsuits. So, as you may know, a wetsuit only makes you warm once the cold water has come in and you've warmed it up around your body. Later on, we use dry suits, and yet still you're cold. It's uncomfortable, but it's really beautiful under the water.
I can imagine it is, and your appreciation of it really does it's infectious as you read the book. Are rivers for you something like a map key, Kurt? I mean, you understand the river and you understand the ecosystem.
Yeah, I guess especially, I moved to Colorado then to become a professor in the early 1980s, and here in this part of the world and in eastern Oregon, southern Oregon perhaps, where you are, those are dry climates, and so rivers are really engines for the whole ecosystem. They pump insects out to other organisms that live along streams, and we know that those riparian zones, those zones along the stream, really are real hot spots for species of birds and bats and even things like lizards and spiders. We find more species and at higher abundance along streams and rivers.
Given all of that, I mean, I'm surprised by the phrase here, streams are deceptively simple ecosystems. I mean, it seems like the complexity is great.
Yeah, another phrase I think that's there that captures what a person ends up feeling is that rivers are really deeper than you think, or streams are deeper than you think, meaning that there's much more going on beyond what most of us can see because of the reflection. But then also these tiny insects that are emerging from streams in the spring that do so much feeding of the animals in the riparian zone, most of us don't really notice that, and yet it can be pounds of protein going to these animals. And when you cut that off, then you end up losing those animals that you might really be interested in.
So if somebody thinks, ooh, I want to get rid of all these yucky bugs, in fact, they're going to be doing a lot to change the ecosystem in a river.
That's right. And similarly for the fish, the shrubs and trees along streams and rivers harbor insects, and a lot of those fall in streams and are direct food source to fish. In fact, especially for small streams where the shrubs are right along the stream and often over the stream, the ants and beetles that stumble in, the wasps and bees that end up falling in streams can be half the diet of the fish, half the energy they need, and really much bigger items than the aquatic bugs that are drifting down the stream. So these linkages between streams and their riparian zones are really important, both for animals that live in the riparian zone as well as fish in streams.
So, Kurt, if asked to give a state of the rivers kind of view, what would you say things are about where we stand?
Well, I think you're just a preamble is you're certainly lucky in Oregon. You have beautiful rivers, many rivers, but the data show that more than half the nation's, the U.S., miles of rivers and streams are in poor condition. Things like excess pollution, when we cut down that riparian vegetation, even toxic chemicals, changes in the flow that we cause in streams with dams and diversions. Those are all things that bring rivers into poor condition. So overall, we're not in good shape. And I think the smallest streams are really hit the hardest because they're so easy to modify. They're so easy to affect.
Oh, that people don't think much of, and they'll stick them through a pipe and underground and all that sort
of
stuff.
Yeah, every little rivulet ends up going downstream and becoming part of a larger stream and river. Every rivulet carries, you know, silt and soil that we might, we often see people just using their shovel along their garden to make a little ditch to get the water off their land, something like that. And when you multiply that by so many cases of that, then you end up with problems downstream.
There's a great quote in the book from Aldo Leopold about ecologists. He says they live in a world of wounds. They live alone in a world of wounds. What does he mean?
Yeah, that's the case where you see things that other people don't see because you know what some of those things mean. Oftentimes, an ecologist will know a lot about a certain aspect, streams in my case, and other people don't see those effects.
All right, much more to talk about with Kurt Fausch. His book is For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey, a fascinating look at all the things that go into and come out of rivers and streams around the world. He's got lots of experience in places outside the American West. We'll talk more with Kurt and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Kurt D. Fausch. He's a professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at Colorado State University. He is the author of a book called For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey. We get to know rivers really well within and without the banks, above and below the water. He just shows us so much in this book. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter. 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So you talked about the general shape of rivers, which you don't see is very good right now. Should we be surprised by this? I mean, we've had a Clean Water Act for more than 40 years now.
We'd be in not as good shape without it. And having traveled to Japan, I've seen the fact that even though our laws aren't perfect, they certainly provide a lot of help for rivers. But I do think that the Clean Water Act can't do everything. The Clean Water Act really is about ensuring the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. But what we often don't remember is things like how we modify the flow can affect those organisms because they're adapted for a certain flow and temperature regime, we say, that is a pattern of flow throughout the year, a pattern of temperature throughout the year. And it doesn't take too much to then change that enough that we get a whole different suite of animals and plants than we had before. So that's an effect that we often think about.
And that's really an excellent point, it seems, because I think that has happened to humankind a lot, where we think, well, there's this great stream here. If we can just dam it up there and hold back a little water, and then we'll release it pretty much at the same flow, just a little less than now, it ought to be just fine, right? And the answer is often no.
It can be no, yes. And we're still trying to figure out exactly where yes and no are changing there. But we've certainly had strong effects. I would say that going to Japan, it's interesting that you bring up dams because we have a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that says that every 50 years those dams have to be relicensed, meaning that if you use them to create water power or hydropower, that every 50 years you have to revisit that. And they don't have that in Japan. Once they made that decision to use a dam and create power, it's there forever, and the river is affected forever. So I think that's a real strength of another one of our laws, is that we revisit it as we get more information in the future. Then we at least have a chance every 50 years to look at those projects.
Which is a big issue in our region at the moment, because FERC has to relicense the dams on the Klamath River, and the proposal at the moment on the table is to take them out.
Yeah, I have to say that I am not fully aware of all the biology and politics for those dams, so I can't speak as intelligently as I'm sure other people there in your region about that.
We've done hours already on the Klamath River, and we'll do hours more. So
right. You're
off the hook for that for today. You mentioned snorkeling already, but what are some of the other ways you explore rivers? It sounds like there's a lot of time you spend in each stream.
Yeah, maybe many people learn that we often capture fish using electricity. That sounds dangerous both for the fish and for us, but that's been done now for 70 years or so, and it does stun the fish. If you do it right, it doesn't injure them or kill them, and you can use it actually to draw fish out from underneath the banks if you use a certain kind of electricity. So I've done an awful lot of that. Most of my work has been done in small streams, and so you end up carrying a backpack unit. It really looks just like the Ghostbusters units out in the old movies. And so you can move up a reach of river and capture fish. We usually do three passes, and from that we're able to determine very closely how many fish are there and weigh and measure them and determine the statistics of that population. So when we do things like try to add habitat, put logs in streams to create pools for trout, for example, then we can use that method to determine, did that do any good, when we compare it to a section where we didn't add logs.
Kurt Fausch, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey. Are you the exact opposite, Kurt, of the people who find river critters slimy and fearful and gross?
Yeah, I grew up thinking that actually that I knew I wanted to work on fish, but I thought I would work on lakes. My parents were from Minnesota, took us back there from Southern California, where my father was a professor also, and that was my great love, lakes, snorkeling in lakes, fishing in lakes. But as it happens, the chance I had in graduate school was to study streams, and yet all those early experiences of catching crayfish, snorkeling, and watching fish, catching fish. It was my mother who loved to go fishing even more than my father, so that was kind of unusual.
You write a lot in the book about your work in Japan with Shigeru Nakano. What made his work so significant?
He was an amazing ecologist. He and I first started trying to understand, again, how these different species of trout, or char in Japan, northern Japan, up in Hokkaido, the northern island, how can they live in the same place at the same time? How is it that they, two different species, can get along that are so very similar? But then he moved to an experimental forest, and his question became, why is the forest important to the stream? And that's where these movements of tiny insects falling into the stream and coming out of the stream began to intrigue him. So what he ended up doing was he was driving across the Hokkaido landscape, where they have agriculture like we do, and he saw these greenhouses, and he thought, my stream would fit right inside that greenhouse. I could use mosquito netting over the stream to cut off these movements and see what happened. So that's what ecologists often want to do, is big field experiments to see what happens, and that was really brilliant. His work then showed, as I said, that when you do that, you cut off the bugs falling into the stream, half the fish go away. And when you cut off the bugs coming out of the stream, half the birds and bats or more go away.
And so it's a process that's almost invisible to somebody who just would stand there and watch it, but by putting these tents over the river, he figured this out.
That's right. And then, there are a lot of ways in ecology to use instruments and isotopes of chemicals to determine how things move. But the work he did and we ended up doing is more like brute force ecology, where when you want to know how many bugs fall in a stream, you put a pan in the stream and you catch them and you fish them out and you weigh them. And you want to know how many bugs emerge into the riparian zone, you put a little floating tent of mosquito netting and catch them and weigh them. So it's a lot of work, but he really found unique things. Nobody else had ever done that before.
So just as we meet Shigeru Nakano in the book, we also come to the term biogeographer, which is not something you hear every day. What does that mean?
Biogeographers are people that try to understand how animals and plants are distributed around the planet. For example, you have certain unique plants there in southern Oregon, in the Siskiyous, and in the Klamath Mountains. The question is, what is their range, and then how did they get there through evolution? Were they always there, or did the climate change and they came from somewhere else? That's really the questions that biogeographers attack.
So they figure out what's supposed to be there and how they got there and why they continue to be there.
That's right. In short, the distribution and abundance of plants and animals is what they study.
Kurt Fausch, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, ecologist at Colorado State University. His book is For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, river observations of your own. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So the animals that occupy streams naturally are well adapted to those streams, it sounds like. But given what we've done around the world, is the stream with its original inhabitants intact the exception around the world?
Well, yes, it's. We often find that things have changed since maybe the earliest observations or measurements of what's in streams. One of the things we really do... two things to streams the most. One is we often introduce species that aren't native there, and the other is we usually affect the riparian zone. We cut it down, we cut the trees down, or we spray for insects, that sort of thing. And so when we introduce species, some of those end up being able to invade. They end up being able to reproduce and push out native species. So that's one big change. And That really occupied a lot of my work over the years, is trying to understand how non-native trout that we introduced around the world affect native trout. So, for example, you have rainbow trout. It's native where you are, but it's not native here in Colorado. And yet it's become a very common trout species and pushed out our native trout, which are cutthroat trout throughout the inland Rocky Mountains.
It does boggle the mind sometimes to see the places we have stocked fish, including at Crater Lake in Oregon, which I remember reading the stuff back from the years just after it happened, where it said, you know, it's been stocked with fish. It's a sportsman's paradise, you know, thinking it was great to put something that was not native to the ecosystem out there.
Yeah, part of it was that we didn't know. Fisheries biologists didn't understand that these fish could potentially take over. And the other was, for example, in Colorado, we had a gold rush, and people used dynamite to catch fish, and there were toxic mining wastes running down rivers, so that they ended up with a situation where they felt like, well, there aren't any trout here anyway. Let's bring some in. You know, it's hard to go back and second-guess all that, but the upshot is we have spread especially brown, rainbow, and brook trout around the planet, and they have been able to establish some places and not others. So one of the things we worked on is trying to predict where are they, where would they establish, where can they establish, and take off and invade, and where might they not be able to, so it might be in a way safer to have them as a stocked fish.
I'm fascinated by the study you detail in the book in Japan about figuring out why certain fish are in certain streams. How did you go about testing that?
Well, we used a combination of things, the snorkeling I described. We went into the mountains of Hokkaido. So Hokkaido is, all of Japan is formed by volcanic mountains. And we wanted to know, in this case, it was for two native fish, why they are where they are. And even for native fish, you know, you talk about that biogeography before. Oftentimes one species arrives first, might be there a half a million years, and then another species comes and pushes it, the first species, out at some places. It's a natural invasion. So there were some ideas that that might have occurred on Hokkaido. Dolly Varden char, which actually occurs in Washington and north of there, all the way around the Pacific Rim to Japan, probably got there first, and then there's another species called white-spotted char that came in from the west and south and pushed it into mountain streams. So we wanted to know, what is it? How could you explain that? Are the two species different in the temperatures they need? And so we ended up looking at it at a local scale, right where the two species occur now, and then broadening out using data other people had collected to, for example, see, could temperature explain where the two species are?
And so ultimately it is temperature that determines what they're comfortable with and why they'll hang around?
Yeah, you know, temperature can affect whether they can outcompete the other species. So as it happens, Dolly Varden do better in cold water, white-spotted char in warmer water. And the short story was that Dolly Varden can live in warmer water downstream, but they get outcompeted. White-spotted char, on the other hand, can't live in colder water upstream. So the cold water headwaters of these mountain streams are really refuges for Dolly Varden on that island.
So they have their own zone. This is like ours.
That's
no,
right.
No spotted char should come up here.
Yeah. Ecologists call that their niche. The places they are both tolerant to and can win in competition when they're there.
Kurt Fausch, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is For the Love of Rivers. I mean, and how significant are the changes in the stream temps you're finding caused by climate change?
Yeah, we're trying to figure that out. You know, if climate change were just a, sort of an inexorable rise in temperature, that means every year it got a tenth of a degree warmer, then it'd be easy to figure out. But the problem, of course, is what's happening is that it's more like climate variability. So that's what ecologists, I think, are trying to figure out for all kinds of things. If char are exposed to temperatures that are unseasonably warm 1 year out of 10, can they still hang on in an area, or what's that going to cause? We do think we see, even in the region where I live, for example, these brown trout I mentioned that come from Europe are really the tolerate the warmest temperatures among trout species. So we see them moving upstream into areas in the mountains where we never really saw them before, and we think that's related, but we're still in the process of trying to assemble the data.
Kurt, you're right in terms of riverscapes. What does that mean?
Well, we ended up finding that fish use much longer reaches than we thought. They don't stay in 20 to 50 yards like fish biologists first thought. So when we think about riverscapes, we think about all the places they need. Maybe the place they need for winter is, you know, 10 miles downstream in a deeper, more stable sort of reach of the river, whereas the place they need to spawn might be another 3 miles upstream in a certain kind of gravel.
And these are not the anadromous fish we're talking about. These are the ones that stay in the stream?
Yeah, actually all kinds. Anadromous fish the same come in and use a range around. But yes, even those that never go to the ocean can use many miles of stream, even small fish. 3-inch-long fish out in the Great Plains here in eastern Colorado use long expanses of river.
You force us to think about so many things with rivers that that I don't think a lot of us have thought about before. Among them, the fact that streams all seem to have their own character, like, you know, the Mississippi is naturally muddy, and that there are also varied places within the earth that produce the water that become streams.
Right. The water that becomes streams really comes from two broad sources, if you break it down. One is that it rain falls on the land, it goes down into the ground and becomes what we call groundwater, and that basically just moves to the low places in the landscape, which are the river channels. So the water can go through the ground, and as it does that, then it picks up certain nutrients and characteristics from whatever the geology is. For example, if there's limestone, it's going to be harder water, but if it's granite, it's going to be softer water. And then the other way water moves is just over the surface of the land. ground is all rock, obviously you can't percolate into it. So it's that mix of groundwater and what we call surface water that makes the character of the stream.
And you're right that natural disasters are good for streams. In what way?
Yeah. Things like floods and landslides and even fires end up shaping streams. They always have shaped streams. Your coastal rivers in Oregon, for example, have a lot of landslides. Those can be affected by man, for example, one being cut trees, but they are natural and they have important rejuvenating force of the stream.
All right, much more about natural disasters and how they affect rivers and more about the rivers themselves with Kurt Fausch, who's the author of For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey. One email waiting. We can take other calls and emails as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Kurt Fausch and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Today we're splashing around in the creek, in a sense. We're talking to Kurt Fausch, an ecologist at Colorado State University, about his new book, For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey, in which he shares a lot of his research over the years, but in a really readable format, and gives us a look inside the complex ecosystem that make up any river, any stream, any tributary. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, stories to share, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about natural disasters being good for streams, so does this mean, conversely, in drought years, for example, without slides, without floods, fires, etc., that rivers get somewhat old?
Get old. I would say both floods and droughts can be natural. Of course, with the changing climate that we believe we're in, we're liable to have more severe ones of those. I think what causes a river to get old is when we restrict the flow and damp the floods, say with, for example, using a dam and diverting the peak flows, which we contemplate here in Colorado. People think, okay, there's this peak of melting snow, let's just use that for human uses. And that seems logical, but on the other hand, if those floods are really cleaning the gravel, for example, that trout or salmon need to spawn, then you're going to end up with, a river aging in a sense and getting so you don't have the fish that you want.
Do rivers, get old enough to die if the conditions don't change, or are they constantly renewing themselves?
Certainly renewing themselves. For example, we had a major flood here on the Front Range of Colorado, north of Denver, where
I remember that, yeah,
where we live, in September, October of 2013, and is that a result of climate change? We don't know. It's sort of at the wrong time of year, but it certainly moved a lot of gravel around and clean gravel. You never like to see, obviously, human life or property destroyed by floods, but river ecologists know that sort of the regime, the flooding that happens every few years is a way to keep a river healthy.
We have an email here from Bruce in Ashland. He says, as we realize how important the tributaries are to our fish-producing creeks, how do we inspire municipalities to remove barriers? He says, Ashland has one last dam in Lithia Park, which is a swimming hole below the major water reservoir for the city. And Bruce writes, if removed, this would provide another half mile of spawning grounds, but year after year, nothing is done. How do we get people to remove obstructions that are no longer used?
Well, I guess I may not know the answer to that. I think it is important, and a reason I wrote this book, to help people understand that, yes, obstructions are important in limiting these fish. They need a whole riverscape to use. I think people in your area probably understand that maybe better than people here. I do think that those who turn the dials on rivers certainly should be responsive to, 200 or 300 people saying, we would like this to happen. can't hurt. So that might be a way to go.
There have been two major removals of dams from the main stem of the Rogue River in southern Oregon in the Medford and Grants Pass areas just in the last several years. The Savage Rapids Dam, which was an irrigation dam taken out near Grants Pass, and an essentially unused hydro dam, the Gold Ray Dam, came out just a few years ago just north of Medford. So the Rogue River essentially flows free now from Lost Creek Dam, a major flood control dam in the Cascades, all the way down to the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. I think that, again, we talked about this FERC relicensing and other, we've seen an awful lot of progress in the last 20 years. Before that, no dams were being removed, really. So now, oftentimes, the power company will look at a dam. They're coming up for a license. It would cost a lot of money for them to put a fish ladder over a license or over a dam, let's say. And they say, you know, we could use that money to generate power somewhere else and just remove this dam. So I think progress is being made.
All right, we have another call here. Let's go to Ron and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kurt Fausch. For the Love of Rivers is his book.
Yeah, hi. The question I have is, I'm a fisherman and been fishing for, you know, years and years and years and years, all over Northern California and Oregon and Washington and somewhat in Colorado. But I've noticed that there were places where we had these really big, huge fires. They would seem to wipe out sections of these streams and pretty much wipe out the aquatic life in those streams as well. And I wondered how long it takes or after a natural disaster like that, a big, huge fire, how long it takes for that stream to rejuvenate, to begin to replace the, you know, the small aquatic life, you know, that the salmonoids need, you know, trout to feed, and how long before the fish re-inhabit. And I presume they come from both ends outside of the fire and then begin to get back into it again. But how long does that take?
Huh, hey, great question. Thanks for that, Ron.
Yeah, Ron. I think you're right on, and this actually relates to the barrier question that we had before. Oftentimes fires are patchy, so that now you're talking about huge fires, and again, it's hard for us to separate those that humans may have caused to be larger than they would have been. But oftentimes fires are patchy, and so there are sort of inholdings, places where fish do survive, and they can recolonize from there. There was some work done in the mountains of Idaho that showed that rainbow trout, which are native to that part of Idaho, can quickly recolonize and then have lots of kids. And the other thing that fires do often is to open up and allow more sunlight to the stream bed, grow more algae, grow more bugs, and suddenly the young fish have much more to eat than they normally would. So even fires can be a rejuvenating aspect. I do know that as you say, you get big fires and then you get large pulses of sediment into streams, and you can see landslides and sediment. Aquatic insects do fly. They can even fly over drainage divides, so they can come from all over. I would say within a year or two, you should be seeing aquatic insects again. And if there are no barriers, you should see fish moving. And that's often the problem that we have, is that we have a fire, but we have some barriers that prevent that recolonization of fish from downstream. So in sort of the natural situation, we had fish moving, and even though we might have wiped out a bunch of fish that were in that region, there were often adult fish ready to come back from a larger river downstream, and that's why it's so important for us to have these free-flowing riverscapes, is so that when these natural disasters happen, then fish can move back in.
Ron's question reminds me that in one of the major fires of the late 80s in the part of Oregon that we serve, the Silver Fire burned about 95,000 acres, and because of the loss of trees, there was a landslide that blocked up Silver Creek and created a lake that lasted, I think, for several weeks. And then the natural dam broke, and Silver Creek returned to normal. But that would have had some really interesting effects that would have been worth studying.
Yeah, you know, I'm familiar with some of the work that's been done north of you along the coast of Oregon, where the landslides will run down through these gullies and bring massive amounts of rock and soil and wood, then what happens is that the river or the stream starts to sort that out. It moves the wood into places the wood, the big logs catch. It moves the gravel, and pretty soon you have really nice places for young, for coho to spawn and then young coho to be. And if you eliminate that, if you don't have that happening, eventually your winter floods are going to take all that out, and you end up scouring the stream down to bedrock with no gravel and no wood. So it's this dynamic process of every so often bringing in those logs and sediment that can be moved around by the stream itself to create that kind of salmon habitat.
Yeah, Kurt, when you talk about the stream sorting things out, it sounds almost human, like it's got its own personality. But I'm sure that's the way a lot of rivers do seem to you, don't they?
I don't know that I think they're human, but they are dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what maybe we forget, is that these systems aren't, these streams aren't the same through time. And they will move their channel, they will move around, their channel will move. So if we can respect that floodplain and not build houses in it, and realize the channel will move, there will be trees coming into it and moving down, we're in a better place there.
And you can't expect the Rogue to be like the Platte, or the Platte to be like the Klamath, or any
no.
of those.
No, or the Rogue to be like itself year to year. It's, certainly if it's locked in a bedrock canyon, it's going to stay there. But the channel moves side to side. The meanders move through time. The river moves around in its floodplain.
Yeah. In addition to the work of Shigeru Nakano detailed in the book, you let us know about Mary Power and her study. What was it she did?
Well, Mary is working in coastal northern California there, a little bit east of Arcata. And she was interested in some similar sorts of things about how the river feeds the landscape all the way up to the ridgeline. So she had a student, John Sabo, who did a little bit similar study, actually at the same time. They were working at the same time. They didn't really know about each other. Sometimes it happens in science. They just put up simple shields because the Eel River, what they work on, is a wider river. They shielded the insects away and then measured how that affected the lizards that lived along the streams, and found that, again, you shield the aquatic insects away from the riparian zone, and 40% of the lizards, I think, left that area.
So it seems like a really small tweaking. I mean, you're not actually changing anything permanently. This isn't like mowing your lawn down to the river and pulling out the shrubs, but just this small change produces a significant difference in what goes on within the river and its banks.
That's right. I think that was what was unique about their work and Nakano's work, is things that people really don't even see. The other thing that we discovered was simply changing the trout species, or adding a non-native trout in Japan, the rainbow trout, which is not native to northern Japan, started this cascade of effects. They ate the insects that fall into streams and forced the Dalivarden char to eat the insects on the bottom of the stream. As a result, fewer of those emerged, and the number of spiders went down, and by extension, birds and so on. So, you know, if you told your mother, hey, do you think adding rainbow trout to a river would affect the birds along the bank, they'd think you were crazy. And yet those are the kind of linkages that actually do occur.
Which people, you know, the rest of us, I think, you know, those of us who are non-scientists are just beginning to make sense of. But even for you as a scientist, I mean, are we trying to put puzzles back together with a lot of the pieces missing, in the sense that we've already greatly altered a lot of the river ecosystems?
Yeah, I think that streams and ecosystems are pretty resilient. It's amazing what can come back when we allow them to rejuvenate themselves. I'm always surprised that sometimes we think a fish species is really rare, and then when we're able to restore a stream, suddenly they're back. Fish have an amazing ability to reproduce. They have, every female has hundreds to thousands of eggs, so they can produce a lot of fish. So we are learning more about these complicated effects, and I think that's what I tried to do in this book, is inspire people to think about how streams are connected to their landscapes and what they can do.
It certainly seems like in our part of the world, anyway, that people are quite fascinated by this and willing to do a lot of work to restore rivers to what they once were. Do you see that growing in your work?
I think it depends on the region. I think you are lucky in Oregon that you have lots of people who are interested in rivers. I would say in Colorado we certainly have trout anglers who are interested, but maybe like eastern Oregon and actually like most drier climates, about 85% of our water is used for agriculture. So that has good and bad aspects. That means, A, we use a lot of it. It also means that if we can become more efficient of using it, and that's what some people are doing now, that we'll be able to save a lot of water.
Hmm. A lot of differences then, I imagine, that you see in the studies between rivers in the Intermountain West, where you work, and the coastal West.
Right. Yeah. At least the coastal West, you're probably not putting in sprinkler systems like we have to. I don't know.
All kinds of stuff. It's a wonderful book and a wonderful look at what goes on inside the banks of the river, above and below the water. For the Love of Rivers, A Scientist's Journey, Dr. Kurt Fausch of Colorado State is its author, and he's been our guest. Kurt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's been a real pleasure.